What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the final episode of the What Bitcoin Did podcast for the year. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have an interview with my buddy, Mr. Marty Bent from the Tales from the Crypt podcast, where we review what happened with Bitcoin and crypto in 2018. But first, I do have a message from my show sponsors. And as I always say, please don't skip these ads. These advertisers pay for me to do this. So have a listen, check them out, see what they do. So let's talk about BlockFi. These have been my regular sponsor for the last few months. Firstly, a big thanks to them for supporting the podcast this year. I really appreciate them getting behind the podcast. And if you haven't listened to my interview with their CEO and founder, Zach Prince, it was episode 51. I recommend you go and check it out. There is so much more to BlockFi than just crypto-backed loans. They are reshaping the future of banking with crypto. They've raised a bunch of money. They've got a whole bunch of cool things coming. But if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, whether you're paying off your credit cards or buying a house, BlockFi helps crypto investors use their Bitcoin, Ether, and Litecoin without selling. BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender in the US, servicing over 46 states with interest rates as low as 7.9%. If you visit blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can learn more about using your crypto without having to sell. And I also want to tell you about my other lead sponsor at the moment, Paxful. Talked about these guys a few times. They have the most comprehensive options for buying Bitcoin. They accept bank transfers, debit and credit cards, PayPal, and Western Union. If you go to the website and check it out, they have over 300 payment options for Bitcoin, which is pretty amazing. They are also a true peer-to-peer Bitcoin marketplace. They have a full-service escrow system, and they offer 24/7 customer support. These guys are awesome. They are a proper Bitcoin company. Go and check them out. And if you trade on Paxful now, you can enjoy 0% escrow fees on trades done with bank transfers up until the end of this year. So head over to Paxful.com, which is Paxful.com, and you can create an account now. So onto my interview with Marty, and I couldn't think of anyone I would rather look back at 2018 with. I am a massive fan of Marty's work. His interview with Caitlin Long was one of the highlights of the year for me. I used it in research and preparation for my interview with Caitlin. So if you haven't checked that out and you haven't checked out Marty's show, please do. I recommend you do. I recommend you subscribe. I've put links to that in the show notes for you. And with everything that's happened, I felt it would be really cool to just record a chilled out episode talking about what's happened through the year, the bear market, crypto journalism, the growth of stablecoins, what's been going on at Coinbase, and also make a few predictions for 2019. Martin was awesome as expected, so yeah, I hope you enjoy this. Look, I just want to say a massive thank you to everyone who supported the show over the year. I did 55 episodes, had over 500,000 downloads. It's pretty awesome. Also, this month, I've achieved profitability with the show. It's lost a lot of money through the year, kind of building it up, but now I'm at the point where it's profitable, which is cool, which means I can do this full time. Also, there's loads of cool stuff coming up next year. I put something out on Twitter. I'm looking to put together a course online. I know a bunch of people want to do their own business, maybe their own podcast or a side gig. I've got all this experience in marketing and building websites and stuff like that. So I'm going to put together a course, put it out there, help people get their own side gigs going or even their own business. So keep an eye out for that. I'm also looking to record some specials this year. I'm looking at doing a 10-year State of the Nation Bitcoin special in January. We're celebrating 10 years of the protocol, so keep an eye out for that. And yeah, just thank you to everyone who supported the show, whatever you've done, from listening to the show or checking out the advertisers, leaving reviews, sharing the show with your friends or families. Anything that any of you have done to support the show has helped me to get to the point where I can do this full time. So that is super cool. If you do want to support the show, please head over to my website. That's at www.whatbitcoindid.com. There's a support section. You can click on that. Loads of things you can do. And I also do want to thank my first patron, top tier sponsor, Elite Crypto Consulting, your personalized trading teacher. Thank you guys for supporting the podcast. Okay, on to the interview. If you have any questions, you know you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I look forward to hearing from you. Marty, how you doing, man?
Doing well, Peter. Doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's great to have you on. You've been somebody I've been listening to for a long time. Are you all ready for Christmas?
No, I am not. I'm not ready at all. We're 2 days away, and I still have a lot to do. Headed home this afternoon, though. I'm a big procrastinator, so this is true to form for me.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same. I went to the shops today, and it was absolute carnage. It was horrible. So listen, it's great to have you on, man. We're going to do a year-end review. I couldn't think of anyone I'd rather do it with. Someone's podcast I really appreciate. So much has happened this year. I don't even know where the year has gone, right? I mean, we were... Last Christmas, we were all kind of over the moon and happy, and everything was glorious, and it's been the exact opposite this year. But funnily enough, I don't know about you, I'm still I'm still kind of happy and positive. I still really enjoyed the year, as awful as this bear market's been.
No, yeah, it was a great year, in my opinion, from a fundamental perspective, at least. A lot of really cool stuff has been built. A lot of years-long debates have sort of been settled, I would say, this year. This year has been a year of settling debates and then moving on from that settlement and sort of exploring a new future, a new frontier, if you will. Despite the price, obviously the public's not as enamored with Bitcoin as they were at this point last year, but I've never been more enamored with Bitcoin myself, the project and sort of the virality of the sort of mission and the people behind it.
What's your position on non-Bitcoin projects? Do you have any kind of anything you like?
I'm sympathetic towards projects that that come from a privacy first perspective and are trying to iterate and make these protocols more private at the protocol level. And then beyond that, like your Ethereums and platform tokens, I definitely appreciate the use cases they're attempting to sort of prove out and appreciate the conversations they're sort of inciting with their ideas. Do not sort of agree with the design structure and their way at solving these ideas, but I do appreciate them nonetheless as ideas and people exploring them. But yeah, and what you would consider a Bitcoin maximalist, I think Bitcoin as a project is sort of a moonshot in itself, and I think it is advantageous for us to focus on Bitcoin in particular, because I think it is a sort of one-shot opportunity at creating a truly sound apolitical money in the digital age. And again, I think it has some of the smartest people in the world working on it. It's obviously got the Lindy effect, the Immaculate Conception. And I just think, for me personally, it makes most sense to spend most of my time focusing and trying to make Bitcoin a better system individually. Because I think a world of 1,000 tokens is a lot weaker than a world with one very strong token, I would argue.
I think that makes sense. I think also everyone kind of goes on this journey, don't they, of what they learn and what they discover. And I think in doing a podcast, in some ways, that accelerates some of your learning, because you have to take sometimes contrarian views, or you have to do certain bits of research to prepare. And I think, with the amount of work you end up doing in preparing a podcast, you will know that you just soak up so much information. And over that time, I've found, and I don't know if it's the same for you, but I've found all roads lead back to Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And then on top of that, I feel like a lot of people become jaded. So as somebody who sort of got into the space in around 2013, 2014, and caught the altcoin bug in that cycle, and really got burned pretty hard when I first jumped into the space, in the altcoin markets in particular. It's funny, this time around, I mean, after I got burned, we went through like a 2-year bear market, and folks still studied Bitcoin and stuck around and was sort of diving deeper into the rabbit hole, if you will, and really came back to Bitcoin, like you said. And then it's funny, like the last 18 months, yes, they're different than the altcoins that were in 2013, but it's like history rhymes. It's very similar sort of pitches that are being replayed and sort of remarketed and new makeup put on them. And despite all that, Bitcoin remains at number one from market cap perspective, from a hash rate perspective, from a mind share perspective. It's been the only sort of steady force in the whole space throughout the last decade.
I think that's a good way of putting it, the only steady force. I've had my own epic burn this year. I've learned a lot from it, and I don't feel bitter about it.
Thank you for sharing that. It was important that you wrote that thread.
It was funny, actually, though, because I got a lot of private DMs of people in very similar positions. So some were worse. I've talked about this. There was one dude who told me, he didn't tell me how much in total, but he said it was 8 figures. Like, he built up to 8 figures, right? And lost mm-hmm. pretty much the lot. I think he said he was down to $300,000, which is a good amount of money. But when you're coming down from plus 10 million, that's a lot. But it was strange. I had a lot of people say, oh, you're so courageous and brave. And I didn't feel like it was at all in any way. I didn't do that. I didn't think, oh, I wasn't scared. I think everything works well in crypto when people are share and they're honest. It's actually, I think, hopefully this year will be a bit more honesty. I would love a project, actually. I'd love a project to come out and say, yeah, we got this whole token thing wrong. It's bullshit and we can't make it work. We can't figure it out.
Right. Well, some of them are starting to. Basis basically just admitted that.
Yeah.
And
I'm thinking one of the ones that's kind of further down the road with shipped products.
Right.
I'm not going to name names, but.
No, there's.
Well, we can.
Yeah, Civic. I mean, no, it's funny. ICOs in particular, I go back and forth. Again, like I said earlier, like I like people exploring ideas and sort of new ways to organize in the digital world. But with that being said, I think a lot of what drove last year's mania was bullshit marketing that, and I would argue that most of the people launching ICOs really had no intention of, I mean, there definitely are people who launched ICOs that have intention to bring a product to market, but I would say 90% probably didn't. They probably get rich quick scheme for a lot of these people.
Yeah, I agree. I think also I give other people a little bit, I'm a little bit more patient with some people's decisions. Like, I'm not a fan of the Civic token or the BAT token, but I can't eloquently explain why it won't work. But I don't believe someone like Brendan Eich set out to scam people, as he's been accused. I think he genuinely believes the BAT token's a good idea. It appears that it isn't, but I don't think he's sat there and thought, oh, I could raise a bunch of money quickly and scam people. I think he thinks BAT is a very good idea for redistributing advertising income.
No, and I completely agree. And that's a common theme for a lot of characters in this space in particular. And that's probably a product of the nature that, a product of the fact that these protocols are basically exploring new territory. So a lot of people have a lot of opportunity to sort of etch themselves in history if they are able to sort of predict how this stuff will play out correctly. And a lot of people stake their egos and their reputations to these ideas. What I would caution people who are making these bold claims and these bold claims in this new territory is, if you are proven to be wrong at any point, just say, "Hey, I made a false prediction. It didn't turn out to be true." And we saw this with Bitcoin Cash and a lot of the people there. Well, the big blockers were sort of proven wrong pretty quickly. But as we've seen through the last year, they're sort of clinging to the idea that they may be right in the long term when the market is sort of telling them that no, they're not. And it's going to hurt them in the long run. It has hurt them monetarily, as Bitmain and Roger Ver and Calvin Ayer, I'm sure, are struggling financially by basically pitching their wagon to Bitcoin Cash and the derivatives of it since the fork. Again, this is an exploratory sort of field where we're discovering these things every day. Everything's being revealed to us. It's like an expanding universe. You're going to be wrong in some of your predictions, and quickly admitting that and then moving on is something I would advise.
Okay, so look, it's been a big year. I've written down some kind of categories for us to explore. Usually I've got loads of questions, but I just thought with you, it'd be easy to bounce some things back. So let's talk about the podcast, Gabe, because that's got super busy, like really mm-hmm. competitive, really healthy. I kind of started November 17, but really kicked it off this year, at the start of this year, taking it a bit more serious. Obviously, you've done very well. Your show's very good. I've really enjoyed Stephen Levera's show. Pomp came in like a steam train with his podcast. I love the Noded podcast. Laura launched a second podcast. Like, the podcast game is pretty healthy in crypto, right?
It's hot right now. There's a lot of content. There's content wherever you turn, which is a good thing. And again, it goes back to the stuff being exploratory. It's people just trying to explain what they've seen and what they're seeing out there. And I can't speak for you, but for me, the reason I started Tales from the Crypt was there was an iteration on the newsletter that I write, Marty's Bent. Started from the fact that I was getting texts and emails from family and friends who knew that I was the Bitcoin guy. And they were like, "I need to learn, like, should I be investing?" And I was like, "I'm not going to tell you whether to invest or not, but hey, I'll write this little note every day that sort of shines a light on a little part of Bitcoin every day, or something like that. I teach you a little part of Bitcoin every day. It was sort of the ethos of Marty's Bent when it started, and it was only going out to family and friends, and I shared the link on Twitter, and it sort of took on a life of its own on Twitter. And so I was at a point at the end of the summer where I was writing, and I was like, ah, people want more. And I figured the next iteration was a podcast where, like, interviewing people in the space to sort of help people get a better understanding of the, because Bitcoin's a huge mental barrier for people. There's a lot of barriers to entry where, and the, because there's so many facets of it, economics, computer science, game theory, you name it. So it's pretty daunting. And so that's what I try to do with the podcast. I'm pretty sure you do as well, is to get the people working in and around Bitcoin and these cryptocurrencies to sort of make it more approachable for the average man.
Yeah, it's a pretty similar journey, actually. I had people back the, it was towards the kind of Q1, Q2 of 17, where people were just asking me about Bitcoin. And I had this email I used to send them, which was like, what it is, why it's important, how you buy it, what your security is. And I just used to forward it to them. And then I did a Facebook group for friends and family where I just explained stuff. I've gone back and read a lot of the content. I find it so embarrassing because I was very new, and a lot of the stuff I'm saying was kind of, it's bollocks, really. But it kind of, it took a life of its own. I started writing. And then the reason I did the podcast, it was, I knew I wanted something with longevity that I can contribute with, because I'm not a trader, really. I'm not very good at it. And also, I felt like when I was trying to learn, there's a lot of complicated things to get your head around. And there's lots of very intellectual debates going on. And I've just got dumb questions I want to ask, really simple ones. So I've always shaped my show as a way of just asking those things that are really basic that other people might want to ask who are too scared to ask, maybe on Reddit, because they don't want to go on and get called an idiot. So that was mine.
No, yeah, and it's and people want to learn. It's just, and so that's the one thing I saw a sort of disconnect in the space, where there was a lot of very technical people trying to explain this and talking in very technical terms that were sort of going over most people's head. And I worked for, or I'm a fan of, a company here in the States, Barstool Sports. I actually wound up working for them. That's actually where the podcast started. But I sort of had this intention of bringing their voice, which is pretty politically incorrect and not as as dry as a lot of the analysis in the space can be. And just trying to make it sort of lighthearted and sort of approachable to like the bro here in the United States that wants to learn more but wants to do it in sort of a fun way.
And that's with some good whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. And then the podcast, you get the smart people drunk, they open up a little bit more, get a little bit more poetic, more cosmic. It works out for everybody.
What's your favorite whiskey?
I'm partial towards Bullet Bourbon, just for like everyday drinking. I'm not like a whiskey snob. Bullet Bourbon's probably my favorite right now. But Matt always brings the Macallan. I can't knock Macallan either. It's a very smooth one. But yeah, I'm partial to Bullet.
Do you know Hudson?
Yes, I know Hudson. Like Hudson as well.
Yeah, I like Hudson. So what was the highlight for you of the year? You know, all the interviews you did, all the podcasts you released, maybe even the ones you heard.
Gosh, it's hard. I'm not going to name my favorite because that would be rude towards my guest. But one podcast that people have told me many times, like after listening to it, have reached out to me in DMs and in person, is Bitcoin Sign Guy. I think that was in the middle of July. He obviously was the guy who held up the Buy Bitcoin sign behind Janet Yellen. And people only know him via that meme, but once you get to sit down and speak with him, you see he's actually a pretty, very bright, sharp young mind. He's got some pretty cool views on Bitcoin and crypto anarchy in particular.
Oh, wicked! Yeah, I heard a really good interview with him on Noded as well. Yeah, he's very articulate, very intelligent guy.
Yeah,
slight rebel.
Yeah, yeah, a waspy rebel, if you will.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, look, the main thread, I think, of the year has been the bear market. I think it's been, in some ways, we may look back on this as a healthy thing. And inevitability as well, in hindsight. I think people have been through it before. You know, you've witnessed one before. I haven't really. I wasn't really that involved in 2013, but I think it's kind of healthy for in the grand scheme of things. But what's your kind of take on the whole year and the bear market, and where do you think we're at?
Yeah. No, it's... I can't believe it's been a whole year already. I believe we're approaching... Actually, no. I think December 17th was the all-time high, correct? I think last mm-hmm. year. So we're just 5 days... We're just 370 days into a bear market now. I can't believe it's already been a year. And like you said, yeah, it's sort of necessary. So this time last year, let's talk about Bitcoin, the blockchain, the actual technology, the system. It was pretty stressed. I mean, fees were at an all-time high. Blocks were slowing down. Exchanges were going down because they could keep up with the demand of the market. From an infrastructure and system perspective, it seems like at that point in time, at least, Bitcoin probably wasn't ready for the mainstream. So the bear market, just from a network stress perspective, is probably good to sort of so that we can make it more efficient and prepare for the next bull run. So this time of less activity on the network is good to sort of focus on building out upgrades that'll make it more efficient and prepare for the next bull run. So from like a technical perspective, I think bear market is good in that regards. And then since it wasn't ready for the mainstream, it's probably imperative that that we have this cleansing of the ICO market and the bullshit that was last year, that mania. So the retail investors in particular who got in last year, and here in the States, I don't know what it was like in the UK, but we had people at Barstool Sports, which is a pretty big like website here in the States, talking about Bitcoin and shitcoins every day. And that's sort of like a massive demographic here in the States. So it was at least in their minds at this point last year. And now the question is how many of that whole is sort of still hanging around and sort of learning those hard lessons and having that journey coming back to Bitcoin, and what percentage of that group is sort of completely jaded and thinks this is all just a huge scam.
Yeah, I think if we do have another bull run, and I'm cautious about wanting or hoping or expecting another bull run because of that, what that means, it does mean like another round of FOMO, another round of people who come in and lose money. And I'm becoming a little bit more conscious about the impact that can have on people, especially with the, like I say, that thread I did had something like 250, 300 DMs. And I reckon at least half of them were people who had lost a lot of money. So mm-hmm. I'm becoming kind of cautious about overthinking, over hoping for it. But one thing I do recognize, if we do have another Bitcoin run and Bitcoin's successful, there are a bunch of shitcoins and tokens that will rally off the back of it, the ones that haven't been wiped out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, these cycles will continue until the market has learned. And again, this is a huge learning process. We're experiencing the monetization of a new monetary good, the likes of which has only happened like very few times throughout the course of human history. So there's going to be a lot of confusion and a lot of hard lessons learned. But with that being said, Bitcoin doesn't realize, the Bitcoin, the protocol doesn't realize all this confusion and money loss of money going on around it. It just produces blocks every 10 minutes. So what you can't lose sight of is during these cycles, Bitcoin continues producing blocks. The protocol is sort of blind to what's going on outside of it, and that's all that really matters. As long as it's enabling peer-to-peer censorship resistant distributed transactions, Bitcoin works, and everything around it is sort of noise, in my opinion, as long as it's sufficiently decentralized. And that's still up for debate whether it is or not right now.
What do you make of Coinbase recently? Because obviously they've started to add a lot of tokens, and my kind of conclusion from this was a couple of things. Firstly, they were losing a lot of business to Binance, by Binance having so many other tokens, people wanted to trade tokens. I think secondly, they obviously raised a lot of money based on, and was it 500 million based on an 8 billion valuation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got an animal to feed there. And then kind of cynically, I imagine that if there was a big sell-off of tokens, you know, they make money on the trade, whether it's a buy or a sell. So I think potentially they also want to be part of that. But they've taken a huge amount of flack recently. I mean, their 12 days of Christmas probably sounded like a great idea when somebody came up with it. But every single release, they kind of got attacked. I mean, especially with the, you know, the 0x, earn money by learning about 0x.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who genuinely needs 0x?
I spoke with somebody building on the 0x protocol here in New York this week, and he said, you probably don't need 0x. So somebody close to the protocol doesn't even think you need the token. So just keep that in mind. Yeah, so Coinbase, I have a tenured history of Coinbase in the Bent. I've written about them many times. I'm not the biggest fan. And yes, like, so let's break it down. Like you said, they are an exchange that has to make a profit. They're VC backed. They have investors they need to pay back. And right now in this space, the most profitable thing you can do as an exchange is add as many tokens as possible to collect those fees and blah, 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 blah. Coinbase in particular, for me personally, since I've been around, and Coinbase was the exchange I used when I first got into the space, and had a very good relationship with Coinbase for a lot of years, but you have to judge a company based on their actions. And over the years, I just think Coinbase, again, I like to hold them to a higher standard, and they have not met my standard as a user who would expect them to sort of be an arbiter of Bitcoin, as a lot of other companies are. And I think this actually comes back to their CEO, Brian Armstrong, who personally, I think, has admitted in the past that Bitcoin has like disappointed him or made him sad because he wasn't able to sort of influence the protocol. He notoriously has backed every contentious hard fork going back to Bitcoin Classic, Bitcoin XT, Bitcoin Unlimited, SegWit 2X. So that's four contentious forks that he really tried to push via Coinbase using their sort of clout to try to force these contentious forks. So that rubbed me the wrong way. And then they get too political in these fork wars. So going all the way back to Ethereum during the DAO fork, I believe they should have, regardless of whether or not they thought Ethereum was going to be successful and Ethereum Classic wasn't, I think they should have offered those tokens to their users immediately. It took them 2 years to do that, and they eventually did it, but it took them 2 years. It should not have taken 2 years. And then going to Bitcoin Cash, they ninja launched it on, I believe it was this day last year, on a Tuesday night, like at 10 p.m., didn't even like announce it or warn anybody that they were going to launch it. They just did it. It was completely irresponsible. It was sort of timed up with a media blitz, like for good media of Bitcoin Cash. It was a really weird scenario. And then on top of that, like you said, more recently, adding more tokens. So now they have more ERC-20 tokens than cryptocurrencies. So they have more tokens than actual protocols. So they're definitely pushing a certain narrative. Brian Armstrong himself has said that he owns more Ethereum than Bitcoin and thinks Ethereum is the future. And then lastly, Hasu on Twitter broke down. I believe Chris Dixon interviewed Brian Armstrong recently, and he basically said that Coinbase wants to create a global payment system, and Bitcoin was not able to fulfill that need. So Coinbase, the company, has a different goal than Bitcoin, the protocol. Bitcoin, yes, it is a payment system. There is a payment system built into Bitcoin. It's not going to compete with PayPal or Visa at the protocol level right now. We're going after sound money with Bitcoin, and that's, I would argue, orders of magnitude more important and for the world to create is like a sound money in the digital age than a really good payment system. So I just believe Coinbase, if you're a Bitcoiner, if you want Bitcoin to succeed, is sort of misaligned with Bitcoin's incentives. I choose not to use them. I advise the freaks out there, anybody who reads or listens to the podcast, to choose other exchanges, do your research. I just think Coinbase has acted poorly too many times in the past to gain my trust.
I think that's a very good point. And another thing I noticed as somebody who's come in late on, he doesn't know the history, I've gone back and read old Bitcoin talk threads and old email chains, and it's very interesting to see the names popping up on there, or names who are leading quite major projects. But what I've noticed is there has been a certain number of, let's say, old school Bitcoiners who have, for business reasons, spread their wings into shitcoins. And it feels like, I don't know, it's almost like their, how do I put this? It's almost like their business interests has changed their opinions on what's important.
Yeah, it's, you live long enough to see yourself become the villain or you die a hero. It's sort of that problem. And yeah, like I would argue Eric Voorhees is a perfect example of this. It's Shapeshift, early Bitcoiner, did a lot of good things for Bitcoin, helped us realize that small transactions are probably not advantageous at the protocol level with Satoshi Dice. So thanks for that, Eric. But yeah, he's for somebody who was once one of the most ardent sort of crypto anarchists or libertarians in the space for freedom and free transactions, Shapeshift has sort of evolved into this KYC AML hellscape. And he's literally built a company that is overtly is in overt conflict with his early sort of principles and stuff. So his principles have changed over time. As I don't know if it's money, I don't know what it is, the lore of profits, I can't speak to that, but it is something that you do witness.
All right, and the other thread that's come through in a lot of this stuff is the rise of the stablecoin. And we've had a lot of them. And you know, I have a love-hate relationship with stablecoins. I wrote a thing on Medium. It's not that great, actually, in hindsight. But one of the things I felt with ICOs, if they were going to be a way of raising capital, if they were going to be used by just, say, traditional businesses who just want to raise capital from a global liquidity pool, you know, rather than go to venture funding, I was like, well, if it was going to work, I would imagine a stablecoin would be much better than, say, Ethereum, because it's less volatile, right? If you don't want to raise 10 million and find out the next day you've got 8 million because the market's dropped 20% and your runway's changed. So I kind of thought, oh, stablecoins make sense. And then I read a bunch of stuff Maximalist said about stablecoins, and they were really against them because of, you know, essentially it's just digital fiat, it's PayPal too. It's like, you know, I was like, okay, that makes sense. And now I hate them. And then I interviewed Zach Prince at BlockFi, and he said to me what was quite interesting. He said there's a huge demand for borrowing dollars around the world. And he said it's not logical for someone in Argentina to put all their money in Bitcoin. It's too volatile. It's too risky. They could, you know, have a small amount. But they want to borrow dollars. And the easiest way for them to borrow dollars is to borrow from BlockFi to issue it as a stable coin, which they can transfer into their local currency on a local exchange. I was like, okay, that makes sense. And then I spoke with Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. And he's a huge fan of MakerDAO, because he said, look, Bitcoin's great. You know, Bitcoin's great for so many things, but its volatility is dangerous for people who don't have a lot of money. You know, a stablecoin is a bit more reliable. So I go from one to the other. Where are you with the whole stablecoin thing?
Stablecoins are only stable until they aren't. So that's where I am. I do think the concept of programmable money and being able to send digital U.S. dollars around the world is a novel idea. Just as in the long term, though, I would not store a significant amount of money in stable. So I would take the opposite approach. Like, if I were going to use a stable coin, it would be sort of like a hot wallet type thing, where I'm moving it to Bitcoin to a stable coin to send on short notice, and keeping most of my holdings in Bitcoin. Because you never, like, stable coins are, again, they're only stable until they're not. So they're susceptible to black swan events and what they're pegged to. So I don't think this is likely to happen for the next 10 to 20 years. But if there were ever, I'm not even going to say 10 to 20 years, I don't know if this will ever happen, but if there was ever like a hyperinflationary instance with the U.S. dollar, the pegged stablecoin is inherently unstable because it's pegged to an unstable currency as well. And that's a long-term threat. And then the proliferation of stablecoins. So like competing stablecoins, they sort of eat at each other's market cap and each other's value prop. So the more stablecoins there are, the sort of less stable the stablecoin landscape becomes, I would argue. So they're an interesting concept. I think programmable money is very interesting and something that will be figured out in the future. I do think it will be Bitcoin. I think people will accept volatility to a certain extent. I don't think Bitcoin will be this volatile forever. And that's another thing. I think people are a bit impatient in this space and expect Bitcoin to be this hyper stable currency out of the box. And that's just not going to happen. This is a monetization event. There's going to be volatility early on in the stage, in the early stages, excuse me. But yeah, with stable coins, maybe they do fill that niche for Bitcoin while it's going from a regime of high volatility to relative stableness, you know, relative stability, excuse me.
Next up, I talked to Marty Moore about what went on with Bitcoin and crypto in 2018, and we also look at some predictions for 2019. But before I do that, I do have a message from my show sponsor, BlockFi. And firstly, massive thank you to those guys for sponsoring the show. Long-term sponsors, it's really helped me to do this. So they also had a huge announcement recently. They raised an additional $4 million of funding, which is going to be used to expand their team and launch some exciting new products, including a crypto savings account, which earns interest, and crypto-backed credit cards. So listen, even if you don't need a loan, you should definitely check them out. Follow them on Twitter, follow them on Facebook, follow them on LinkedIn, sign up to their newsletter. You definitely want to keep an eye out for what these guys are going to be doing over the next year. And if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender in the US, servicing over 46 states with interest rates as low as 7.9%. Also, BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. BlockFi is the best way to get USD funding without having to sell your crypto, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. If you visit blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can learn more about using your crypto without selling. Okay, so let's talk about Bitcoin, the year for Bitcoin. It's like been a mixed bag of, if we forget about price, I think everyone knows what's happened with the price. So, but let's talk about like what's been going on. There's been a huge range of things. There's been a huge amount of FUD still. People still spreading the nonsense about energy waste and things like that. So there's been a huge amount of FUD. There's, you know, the likes of Nirul Rubini attacking it, etc., etc. But at the same time, every measure I look for Bitcoin seems to be up. Transactions, volume. You know, I know hash rates dropped, but there was FUD around that as well. Lightning's growing, infrastructure's growing. You know, even though we don't have an ETF, the fact that it's being discussed so regularly at such a high level is really interesting. Jay Clayton's comments were very positive. Like, there's a huge amount of positive stuff's happened for Bitcoin. So how do you balance the year for Bitcoin itself?
Yeah, no, like I said, I think Bitcoin fundamentally has never been better. I'm pulling up a tweet here. Jameson was tweeting yesterday. Despite massive exchange rate decline forced many miners offline due to unprofitability, Bitcoin's hash rate doubled during 2018 from 19 to 38 exahash. Yeah, so despite the precipitous hash rate decline since the summer or since September, hash rate's still double what it was this time last year. So the network's that much more secure, or there's that much more energy focused on the network. And then, like you said, Lightning's beginning to proliferate, and the experimentation I'm seeing around Lightning in particular is blowing my mind. Like, we're close to sort of 1 to 3 click UX experiences where users can spin up a node, open up channels, and travel the web with a Lightning wallet in an extension. We're not that far away. I mean, the vision's there. It's being proven out. There's a lot of people sort of gravitating towards Lightning to build on it. At the BitDevs meeting here in New York in particular, there's been a lot of people who have previously worked on other protocols that have started coming to Bitcoin meetups just because of Lightning has made it a lot easier to build on. So I think we're going to see sort of an exponential rise in the activity on Lightning in and around it. So that is an incredible sort of development. And it goes back to what I was saying in the beginning of the episode, where this is the year where we're moving on from settled debates and sort of proving out the use cases that we believe are the most viable to scale this system in layers. And it seems that base layer being very efficient for large transactions in Lightning is beginning to take form. So that's very great to see. And then, yeah, protocol development continues to amaze me. Peter Woola just came out with a new proposal that would make the initial sync, I think, a lot less data intensive, which is huge for ensuring the decentralization in the long term. So small tweaks like this are very encouraging. And then on top of that, though, we should mention the CVE bug. We were reminded pretty starkly that bugs do exist, and they will exist, and they can be pretty catastrophic bugs. We're lucky that that bug in particular was not exploited, but it did sneak its way into the code base. So these developers, though I've been very generous towards them, they are fallible at the end of the day, and this is humans writing code, so we always have to have that in mind when building the system as well. And I would actually argue that we should probably be more careful and maybe move a little bit more slowly than we have been. There's a lot that's happened in development, both good and sort of worrisome.
I did a really interesting interview the other week with Brian Bishop, trying to find out and understand a bit more about Bitcoin development, because I don't understand a thing about it. He was great. He was really patient with me and very articulate, but he was very clear to me that there are bugs in Bitcoin that they know about, mm-hmm. that exist, and there are bugs in Bitcoin they're unaware of, and that's always going to be the case. And I also remember hearing, I think it was Nick Carter saying once, that he looks forward to a time where the base chain calcifies.
Yes.
There are no more updates, which I think is kind of interesting.
I mean, that's ideally the point you want to get to. So that's actually something I say to my friends in Bitcoin a lot, is like, I want Bitcoin to be as boring as possible as soon as possible. Like, the quicker it becomes boring and sort of solidified in its ways at the protocol level, like, again, like I said, it only really needs to do one thing and continue to do that thing, and we'll be good into perpetuity. And that's enable peer-to-peer censorship-resistant distributed transactions roughly every 10 minutes. And if we can just ossify that single process, then anchor trust into that protocol level via second and third layers, I think we'll be good. And like I said, the quicker we get to that point, the better for Bitcoin, because you want Bitcoin's selling point to sort of be very, very bland in the future. You don't even want to have to talk about the technical details. You just want to tell people that it works, and you have a certain amount of certainty that it will work that way into perpetuity.
Where do you stand on fungibility? Because, you know, there is progress, but it's slow. And I've heard, all the interviews I've done, I've had so many different views. Most people kind of want it. And Brian, actually, his point as well is that you should support fungibility, because fungibility improves scaling, which I hadn't heard. But also, there are some people who said they prefer if the base chain wasn't private, if you can analyze the base chain and you can see if the Bitcoin people holding, and especially when it comes to, say, Wall Street adoption, where you want to ensure that there is no fractional reserve Bitcoin being operated. And so there's kind of different views, and I'm kind of in the middle now. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, fungibility is a very interesting topic, and I think, yeah, so I've been saying this for a while, it's going to be the next big block size war, or what, scaling war, is going to be a fungibility war. And I, so again, it all comes back to trade-offs. And like you said, you have to trade off at the protocol level in particular. Do you want complete anonymity or complete fungibility? Or do you want auditability, to know that the supply is 21 million? And this is at the protocol level only. And so people are pretty certain that if we get complete fungibility at the protocol level, it won't always be possible to check the supply. Myself, I got into this for Sound Money, and I think you should be able to check the supply, so I'm not for complete fungibility at the protocol level. I think there are things you can do with things like CoinJoin. And then if we get Schnorr signatures in, I think you can have a degree of fungibility at the protocol level that is acceptable for me as a user. It just makes it a lot harder for people to find you. It makes people have to do very good detective work. It's not foolproof, but I think it's enough fungibility at the protocol level, especially with things like with Lightning, where if you take it to the Lightning network, you can even make it more obscure and more private on those other layers. I think the ability to audit the supply at any time is imperative for Bitcoin's value prop. So I think a degree of fungibility at the protocol level is fine, but I think if it ever got to a point where we had to decide complete fungibility at the protocol level and not being able to audit, I don't think I would support that.
Okay. Another big topic for the year for me was journalism within crypto and Bitcoin. So, and there's a few things I've noticed. Obviously, the Block have arrived with their unique form of kind of investigative journalism, but also some really good analysis work. But they've come in kind of all guns blazing. I think they've in net done a really good job. We also have the exposure that a number of people were allowing for pay for coverage, which is morally wrong. We've had Bitcoin Magazine going Bitcoin only, which I think is super cool. And then we've had just really crappy reporting from mainstream press, like the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, CNBC. So what do you make of the whole, what's happened with journalism in this space?
Yeah, no, I think the entrance of the Block has been great, just, if not only to light a fire under the ass of everybody else in the space. So I think journalistically struggle at some points. CoinDesk has been very good throughout the years. Bitcoin Magazine has been the creme de la creme, in my opinion. I think Aaron Van Weerdum is the best writer in the space. So I really like what Bitcoin Magazine has done up to this point, and the Block entering the space, I think... Frank Shapiro is a very good journalist. They've got a very good young crew there that's dedicated to sort of, I don't want to say start controversy, but like get under the scammer skin, which I'm all for. I think it's been good. And then, so mainstream, they're still learning, and that's actually, I don't know if I'll ever ever hold my breath that the mainstream will come around. There's a few good journalists in the mainstream who get it. I would argue Joe Weisenthal, Bloomberg gets it, a couple others get it, but most throughout the mainstream crypto beat are pretty clueless and just spit out falsities. And so I think it's imperative that we have companies like The Block coming in, and then I'll shill my own thing. Like I think individuals who have been in the space, like yourself, and are small content creators like us, are imperative as well, to give a different perspective. And I think crypto is going to sort of like piggyback off of small content creators who actually know what they're talking about into the future. Because again, this is such an arduous subject to tackle, and just thinking of a mainstream media beat reporter figuring this out and being able to report on it accurately, again, don't hold your breath for that.
Yeah, definitely. So the last thing I want to talk about the year is I just want to go back onto tokens a little bit, but specifically towards venture capital and what's happened with venture capital money in the space. So it seems to me that whilst there are a number of funds who've lost money and closed down, there is still a narrative of build a better Bitcoin and token economics within a number of funds. I'm not going to directly criticize them, but and actually I find some of what they're doing quite interesting, say over at Multicoin. It's not calling them out as a fan, but if there is something that's going to work, they're going to find it because they're challenging and trying everything. But what I do worry, though, is that actually all these funds are really just kind of pushing narratives which are probably going to fail. And I don't understand why these seemingly smart people don't get it.
Well, that's the thing, Peter. These seemingly smart people are not as smart as they seem. In my opinion. And that's, like I said, there's... earlier in the episode, people cling to these ideas, these lofty ideas that these protocols can solve, and sort of hitch their reputations to it. A lot of the VC funds have in the space, and I think that's a reason why Coinbase is doing what it's doing, because its biggest investor, A16Z, is a big believer in Ethereum and Web3, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of pressure from Coinbase's investors to sort of flesh out this this idea, just to sort of justify their investments. So that's another thing you have to take into account as a retail investor, as somebody who's looking at the space from an outside perspective looking in. A lot of the VC funds, I mean, to me, they're just completely anathema to the whole ethos of Bitcoin, the fact that you could get a considerable percentage of a network before it's open to the public. Just doesn't make any sense to me from a Bitcoin perspective. It sort of defeats the whole purpose of a decentralized open source system. So all these pre-sales and like deals that are basically VC friends getting in at an early stage, getting a discount, and then trying to grow the network with their social networks, with their social clout. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. That's what I think it is. It's a lot of rich people trying to use their social clout to will something into existence, but they will be found to be naive in the long run, I think. I believe a lot of them are naive, that they can sort of bootstrap these what are supposed to be organic protocols very inorganically. So just from a heuristic standpoint, that's the way I view it. We'll see, though. We'll see.
All right, man. Well, listen, look, I think that's covered kind of the main things that went on this year. Unless there's anything else you want to add, I want to go through a few predictions for next year with you.
Let me think. Yeah, the ETF didn't come. Don't hold your breath for the ETF either. It's been clamored about since 2013. The Winklevii were coming out with one 5 years ago. So keep that in mind as the headlines about an ETF keep coming out.
We do apparently have BACT to come in, though, which certain people like Jake Chavinsky thinks is way more important than an ETF.
Yes. And they're even having they just had to push back their initial launch, correct?
Yeah, they did. And there was like a rumor up on, I think it might have been the block pushed it might get delayed again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so don't hold your breath for these mainstream financial products. That's a prediction, number one.
Well, it's funny also, did you read the Tim May thing on CoinDesk?
The one that he wrote?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean that blew my mind, right? So I read through that. I've been kind of like wanting the ETF to happen and, you know, expansion, et cetera, et cetera. So something he said in there was really interesting. He said, "I can't speak for what Satoshi intended, but I sure don't think it involved Bitcoin exchanges that have draconian rules about KYC, AML, passport, freezes on accounts, and laws about reporting suspicious activity to the local secret police. There's a real possibility that all the noise about governance regulation of blockchain will effectively create a surveillance state, a dossier society. I think Satoshi would barf, or at least work on a replacement for Bitcoin, as he first described in 2008, 2009. And that kind of knocked me back a bit when I read that. I was kind of like, oh, shit. Yeah, like the original vision, the original dream. And in some ways, I won't, but, and I haven't got a lot left now anyway, but some ways I almost thought, God, I almost want to sell all my Bitcoin, not have any Bitcoin. So I approach it from an impartial point of view, not a personal financial incentive. And therefore, my consideration for Bitcoin and for what is good for Bitcoin and users, not what is good for price growth, right?
Yeah, no, and this is something Matt and I, in particular, harp on a lot on Rabbit Hole Recap, is if Bitcoin is about taking your financial sovereignty into your hands. So it is a process, number one. It is not easy, number two, but it is a responsibility that I think is worthwhile. So we are always encouraging people to learn, first of all, learn how to use wallet software, become comfortable using a personal wallet software, and then move your Bitcoin to a personal wallet, run a node, and participate in the consensus. Because I think in the long run, if Bitcoin is to succeed, we do need people using Bitcoin. We can't let these exchanges, I would argue, we can't let them concentrate so much supply. So I do think as Bitcoiners, we should be advocating that people learn how to take the stuff into their own hands. Again, first learn how to use a wallet, practice, become comfortable with it before moving your money to it. And then on top of that, we need companies like Casa and Unchained, companies working on unique multi-signature sort of schemes that give the user a lot more control when they're engaging with custody services. We need the UX in that area to improve, and I think it will improve, and it is improving. But yeah, I do think Tim, rest in peace, Tim. I do think he, that warning is very warranted. Like, we do not want this system to become draconian run by Coinbase. That's why I'm very anti Coinbase, because I do think they are trying to position themselves to become this sort of arbiter of the quote unquote fake, like, decentralized digital future.
Right. Okay, man. So listen, 2019 predictions. Actually, I've got it here written, predictions and hopes. It's just predictions about like what's going to happen, but there's the things you hope will happen as well, and they're kind of slightly different. So let's go with the market. Let's talk about Bitcoin, then all other projects kind of together, and then personally for yourself with your podcast and your own work. So what do you think is going to happen with the market in 2019? You don't have to give me a price, but just like a general feel.
I bet we're sideways for most of it. Sideways to down for most of it. Then maybe a pop at the end of the year. I don't know. I bet it's going to be a boring year price-wise. I hope so. I could be wrong.
Because a boring year means people focusing on still building, right?
Yeah, that, and I want to accumulate more Bitcoin. Predictions always suck. I think sideways, but I wouldn't be surprised if, again, it's all indicative on news event, or not news events, but sort of the developments around Bitcoin. So it's getting pretty frothy in the geopolitical landscape right now. We'll see how that plays out, and if that if Bitcoin factors into that macro play at all. It's yet to be seen. There's a prediction. We will find out how Bitcoin plays into this macro situation in 2019.
Okay, and then on the tech side of Bitcoin, what are your kind of hopes and predictions technology-wise? I'm like, my nod is towards Lightning, but you tell me.
So Schnorr Signatures, the first attempt to... The first proposal to add Schnorr signatures to the Bitcoin protocol level, was just proposed earlier this week. So I would like the discussion around that proposal in particular, and then other proposals, if people want to propose them, how to get Schnorr signatures added at the protocol level in Bitcoin, and what you would include in a package that adds Schnorr signatures. I would love to see, and I believe it will. So this is my prediction. The conversation around this upgrade in particular will begin to get louder, and I think we'll have, by the end of the year, a path forward with how to implement Schnorr signatures. And so what we have to figure out is, we will do that via soft fork, and it's just how do we come to consensus on implementing the soft fork. So discussion around the soft fork will heat up as well.
And for those who don't know, what are Schnorr signatures? It's a tongue twister, right? What are Schnorr signatures?
Schnorr signatures. So let me preface this with, I am not the most technical Bitcoiner out there, but Schnorr signatures is a different signature scheme that allows you to aggregate signatures. So in multi-sig transactions in particular, you'll be able to do everything with one signature, whereas it takes multiple signatures for each output right now. And this will be a boon to fungibility, number one, and then number two, data space. So it'll make the use of data on the blockchain very much more efficient. And so it's a different signature scheme to ECDSA, which we're using now. which Satoshi chose particularly one star in the project because Schnorr signature number one was patented and had not been tested as much. So people think that a decade since Bitcoin's launch, Schnorr has sort of been tested. The patent is not there anymore, and it's probably most advantageous to add it. It just makes a bit more sense.
And what do you think is going to happen? Everything not Bitcoin. What do you think is going to happen with Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash, Ripple Coin, everything else?
I think Ethereum will continue to struggle on their transition to proof of stake. I don't think they'll ever truly transition to full proof of stake, which in turn, I think, invalidates their whole narrative and their whole investment thesis. So I think the struggle for that transition will continue. From an ICO perspective, I expect the SEC to step in more heavily. I think we'll see more arrest. I think we'll see some big names get taken down, maybe head of tokens get taken down, maybe head of decentralized projects get taken down. We'll see. Maybe this is the year that the SEC and the regulators decide to come in and sort of clean house.
All right, man. And then any other predictions? Or any other hopes? I prefer hopes.
I bet we get the Trump Bitcoin tweet in 2019.
That would be awesome. Like, what's coming up for you next year? What's coming up with the podcast? What are you hoping for?
Just hoping to make it another year. I don't know. Hopefully I figure out my sound. That's the bane of my existence. The bane of my listeners' existence as well, from what I hear. No, just keep it going.
That's
just
all of us.
Yeah.
Everyone who does a podcast, the bane of our life is the sound. It's the audio from the guest. It's the merging of the audio. Actually, I don't know about you. Every show I complete, I have this massive panic that the audio didn't record.
Well, I learned my lesson hard when I didn't hit record with Bitcoin Sign Guy, and we had a 30-minute conversation that went unrecorded. So we had to restart. It was a hard lesson learned. And I always check to make sure I hit record. But you only have to learn it once. So I would advise you to forget to hit record for like 5 minutes of a conversation. You'll be like, oh, forgot to hit record. And then you'll never forget again.
I had it last week. I interviewed Mike Dudas from The Block. And I just lost the intro where we were talking about football and talking about Liverpool. But I kind of wish we'd had it. And that's the first time I'd done it. But I still have the panic afterwards. And sound is the bane of all our lives, right? Getting it right is hard.
It's not easy, especially if you don't have a background in like sound engineering. I just hit record and try to do my best to get the levels in a certain spot.
I think you do a cracking job. I love your show, man. Well, listen, look.
Love your show too, man. Yeah.
Well, you know what? Like, let's do a pump. Let's take one from Pomp. Do you want to ask me anything before we close out?
He stumped me on this one.
Seeing as it's Christmas, you can ask me a question if you want.
No, I'm interested to see. So as somebody who's coming more and more or has come full circle back around to Bitcoin, like what was, I mean, you had your thread, obviously you learned a lot of hard lessons, but like, I just want to make sure I'm not crazy. Like, do you see the value proposition in sound money and focusing on Bitcoin in the long run?
Yeah, absolutely. The funny thing was, I didn't lose most of my money on tokens, right? I lost most of my money mining Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody was asking me about that the other day, and I said, the reason I'm not upset is because in the long term, like, I'm always going to have a job and be able to support my family. So I'm not worried about money. And if me losing a few $100,000 on Bitcoin mining in the long term means I still contributed towards the security of what could be the most important technical innovation of our time, then I accept being that collateral damage, right? I accept that. Okay, well, at least I know I partly contributed towards the security of Bitcoin. I'm proud about that. But no, it does make sense to me. And I'm somebody who takes a long time to understand things. I've sat in debates, whether it's on Telegram, in Reddit, and I'm seeing very intellectual people debate things. And I find it hard to kind of keep up. But the sound money does make sense. It really does make sense to me. And also with Bitcoin, what really makes sense to me is the decentralized side of it. Seeing how much nonsense happens on centralized projects, you know, whether it's something they're changing their monetary policy, or there's a meeting somewhere, or like some guy scams some money. I've kind of come to really appreciate how Bitcoin is run, and how there is this focus on decentralization, and how there's this patience amongst the developers to do the right things. And like the thing that Brian Bishop said to me is that none of the developers care about price. They don't wake up and think, what can I do for Bitcoin today which will make the price better? They don't care. They want to build the best product. They want to take their time. I don't know. I just think there's so many things with Bitcoin that make sense. And I think it all comes down to it. I think it's such an important project, and I trust the people who are central, excuse my term, but central to its future. The people I don't mean it's centralized, but the people who are kind of building it, developing it, all the kind of people I meet and interview, it just seems so important. So, I mean, my podcast went from anything, like I would interview anyone, like token leaders and traders, and it's really gone very focused on Bitcoin. And some people have got the chicken and egg the wrong way around with that. They're like, oh, you're just becoming a Bitcoin maximalist, blah, blah, blah. I was like, no, the show has led me down to that. All mm-hmm. the interviews and all the researchers. And I can't articulate it well, but I've come to, it's almost like, are you a programmer?
I'm not.
Right. I tried to learn programming once. I tried to learn JavaScript, and I struggled and struggled. And then one day it just clicked. And I don't know why. I just understood the structure of creating a script. I didn't do anything advanced. It's kind of something just clicked at some point with Bitcoin. It's kind of like everything kind of fell into place in my mind. I was like, all this other stuff is just noise and a waste of time. Some of it might be interesting. There's certainly some interesting use cases for stable coins. And, you know, I like the Brave browser, and I like the idea of supporting content providers. So there's bits here or there that I find interesting. But there's so much to talk about with Bitcoin. There's so much opportunity. I trust it the most. I trust the people involved with it the most, that I just think it's changed my focus now. And now what I think for next year is focus on the podcast. And I want to accumulate Bitcoin by working for it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I kind of, it's a whole new mentality. It's like, yes, I'm going to get paid some dollars for advertising for the podcast, but when I get some people who do like tips, or like a couple of people have subscribed to have the podcast without ads for $60 for the year and they paid in Bitcoin, I'm like, I really like that Bitcoin that I earned there.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate it. And yeah, so that's my focus change. And actually, it's funny, like at the start of this interview, I wrote down on this my to-do list that I need to go through my website and just clear out all the junk I've written about tokens and approach before, because my whole mentality has changed. So I don't know if I articulated it in the way you want, but
no,
yeah, that's how I feel.
No, that's the common theme. Like I talked about this with Hasu on Tales from the Crypt. He came to it via negativa, just by way of taking things away. And once you take everything away, you realize, again, going back to the core of our discussion, is as long as Bitcoin's producing blocks roughly every 10 minutes in a decentralized fashion, we're Gucci. And the simplicity of that scares a lot of people. They think everything needs to be a bit more complex and you need to get these crazy consensus mechanisms, but there's beauty in Bitcoin's simplicity at the end of the day, I would argue.
Mate, well, I think that's a perfect way to end it. So I'm going to wish you a happy Christmas, a great new year. This is going to be the final show of the year that's going to go out next Friday. I think it's a fitting way to end it. Thank you for all your work. I absolutely love your podcast. You've probably heard it a few times now, but like I've met people and I've said, no, I think you need to be interviewed by Marty, because I think you've got a real way of kind of calming people and just getting them to open up. And so there's a few people I've said, when I was with Hester Peirce, I said, you really should be interviewed by Marty Bent. I think he would really kind of bring a great interview out of you. But yeah, no, thank you for everything you've done. You know, any support you've given to me as well, just yeah, thank you, and have a great Christmas.
Well, the feeling is mutual, Peter. What Bitcoin did is an incredible resource to the community as well. Thank you for doing what you do. Thank you for having me on. Merry Christmas to you as well.
Okay, and we'll see you in New York for some whiskeys with Matt at some point.
Definitely.
All right, man. Take care.
All right, see ya.
Okay, so what did you make of that? Marty's pretty cool, right? I love his take on the space. And listen, as I said in the intro, If you haven't checked out his podcast, what are you doing? You need to go and listen to Tales from the Crypt. You need to subscribe. You're definitely missing out. I've put links to that in the show notes. Also, what did you make of the year? I would love to hear from you. How are you feeling about 2019? Personally, I couldn't be more excited, especially for Bitcoin. Whatever happens to the price, Bitcoin continues to grow. So much cool stuff happening. I'm going to get my Casa node soon, so I'm going to be checking out the Lightning Network. But so much cool stuff is happening. I can't wait. And also, big thank you to everyone who has supported the show. From those who leave me a review on iTunes, to those who sponsor the podcast, whether you share the show out, whatever you do to support the show, thank you so much. You've made this a full-time gig for me. But listen, look, it's the end of the year. If you want to support the show, here are all the things you can do. Yes, you can listen to the ads on the podcast. If you are a regular listener and you skip the ads in future, just try and listen to them because that helps support the show. You can also become a patron. I've got 56 now. That's at patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. You can subscribe to receive the show without ads. Costs $5 a month, but there's some other options in there, so go and check those out. If you don't want to become a patron, but you want to subscribe, get the ad-free version. I have a couple of people who play in Bitcoin. Just email me. We can figure that out. You can also become a show sponsor. I've got some slots available in January and February, so get in touch. Let me know. We can work something out. We can organize a call and discuss what you're trying to achieve, see how the podcast can help. You can also leave me a review on iTunes or click on the subscribe button. Both help with the rankings when people are searching on iTunes, so that's pretty cool. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Medium. I'm at WhatBitcoin and everything, although my Twitter personal profile is at Peter McCormack. Follow me. Reach out to me. DMs are always open. You can check out my website. That's www.whatbitcoindid.com. I'm going to do a bunch more work to that this year, so keep an eye out for that. You can sign up to my newsletter. I just don't have the time to do the daily one anymore. I tried. Sorry if anyone did like receiving that. Again, I need to update my website to say that. And you can share the show out with your friends and family. Listen, thank you so much. From the bottom of my heart, all the support I get for the podcast is utterly amazing. I've got so much planned for 2019. Feel free to get in touch if you've got ideas. I love hearing from you. I usually get back to anyone who gets in touch. I hope you all have a great new year. If you want to reach out to me, you can email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I look forward to hearing from you. And yeah, I look forward to seeing you all in 2019.